All right. I'd like you to first describe your pathway to addiction research and tell us a little bit about how you were trained, whether you were associated with any particular scientific discipline or approach during that training, and what initially attracted you to the field of addiction.
Well, so I had received a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Minnesota, and I was not particularly a serious student. I did manage to find a wife and get married, but then I didn't really know what I was going to do next, and so I tried a bunch of things, but among them was to apply to psychology graduate programs. I got accepted in very few, and went to one of the ones that did accept me, which was the University of Houston. And I didn't know anybody there or anything about what areas they were in. I didn't have really a clue what I was going to do, except that I would keep me, give me something to do for a year. And that was the Vietnam War years. And so I also was interested in retaining my exemption from the service. So I got into graduate school. And then, you know, we had an organizational meeting like within the first few days that I was there. And it was done by the head of the program, whose name was Daniel Shear, and he said, you know, ask the students, first year students, to select their, you know, major area. Who were they going to work with? Who was going to, you know, what had they worked out? What was their plan for research for the coming year? And apparently everybody knew, and they had all selected, and everything had all been worked out, and I didn't have a clue. So I, you know, whatever, I went through this whole process. I was feeling a little sheepish, and finally at the end he says, well, who hasn't been signed up yet? And I kind of, you know, sheepishly raised my hand, and he says, well, who are you? And I said, well, you know, Bolster. And he says, oh, well, let's see. Well, all we have left is psychopharmacology. I said, well, what is that? And make a long story short, that was sort of what got me into it. I then was, in a sense, by default, assigned a lab, went to work with a gentleman named Robert T. Harris, who is a psychologist working in a psychopharmacology drug abuse lab at what then was called the Houston State Psychiatric Institute. It subsequently got renamed as the Texas Research Institute for Mental Sciences, but it was on the Texas Medical Center campus. It was a location of quite a number of fairly accomplished psychiatry, psychopharmacologists, investigators, and I just jumped into that situation, and next thing I know, I am one.
And what year?
That was 1966 is when I began graduate school, and 70 is when I finished. So.
And what kind of research priorities did they have in that lab?
Well, the particular lab that I was assigned, again, this was really by default, was this was a behavioral pharmacology research laboratory doing animal studies of drugs and drug abuse, and my advisor, Robert Harris, had some studies going on in various animal models of addiction, and I basically just jumped in to do what it is that he was doing. But the Institute had a much broader interest, of course, and they would be, I would say, kind of a fairly early representation of a strong biological psychiatry focused. The head of it was a guy named William McIsaac, actually quite a well-known biological psychiatrist, was very involved in identifying serotonin as a important transmitter in brain diseases. And so it was quite an exciting place with a number of investigators in broad areas, and I just happened to be in the behavioral pharmacology lab.
And up to that point, then, you'd had no contact with addicts or had any former interest?
Aside from myself, no, not really. I mean,
Do you want to explain that? Comment?
Well, you know, I was the usual college student with respect to alcohol and cigarettes, so I guess I supposedly was certainly that. But no, I was not. My dad was a pharmacist, and so I suppose I knew what drugs were, but really, drug abuse never entered my mind as something I would work in, and or psychopharmacology for that matter. I think in some sense, I actually thought maybe I would become a clinical psychologist and do counseling, and I think that was probably a pretty poor self-perception of what my skill set is.
All right, so how would you characterize the field of, would you now say you're in behavioral pharmacology?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I'm management, and I'm editing a major journal and things of that type, which have kind of taken me out of my own personal area of research, but I still do have a behavioral pharmacology laboratory. I still have NIH grants to do behavioral pharmacology, and so I have begun doing it in 66, and I'm still doing it.
And now you're senior, having done it.
Presumably.
Quite a while. Can you characterize the difference between the field now and the field then when you entered it?
Yeah. Well, it's, of course, much bigger, and it's much more connected now with broader areas of addiction research. I think at the time that it began, it was somewhat more oriented towards pharmacology and a relatively smaller, you know, set of particular interests. Now that field is broadly connected to treatment research and many other areas of substance abuse concern, abuse liability assessment, and things of that type. So it's certainly broadened. I suppose I should be embarrassed to say that some of the models that we were using in late 1960s, I'm still using in a broad sense. I mean, I was one of the people that was very early involved in a procedure called drug discrimination, and I think Bob Harris and I, my advisor and I, published really some of the very first papers in that area, and I'm still doing that research now, and I did it in between. We were doing drug self-administration research. This is, and again, that was, we were just sort of beginning that work that was just really taking off at that time. Drug self-administration research of the type that I'm doing now is just really getting launched in a fundamental sense. Bob Schuster and Travis Thompson had written a paper in 74 that, of course, I didn't know right away, but ultimately became familiar with that paper. And Travis Thompson and Bob Schuster published the first behavioral pharmacology textbook in 1968. And, you know, that was a very big influence on me and kind of, I think, had a big influence on the field because it sort of shaped it in a lot of ways. And anyway, those methods that are still, I think, very important components of animal models of addiction were really begun then and are still in wide use. They've, of course, been elaborated and improved, I hope, and, you know, expanded in a lot of ways. But so it's not been a dramatic change.
Could you differentiate for me drug self-administration, drug discrimination?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so drug self-administration is the easiest to explain. It's essentially a situation in which, you know, animals are allowed to voluntarily take drugs, and by various mechanisms, they may drink them or they may, in our case, press switches in order to activate pumps that put the drugs right into their vein. But essentially, this all is sort of comes from a tradition of experimental psychology research that many people would associate with B.F. Skinner. And, you know, Skinner had rats that were pushing levers to get food pellets, and it was essentially exactly that model, except that the rats pushed levers to get drug injections. And we spent a lot of time showing that they were fundamentally comparable in a way. So that's drug self-administration. It's been elaborated in a lot of ways, but that's basically what it is. Drug discrimination is a bit harder to understand. This is essentially where an animal is given a choice of two different responses to make. One of them is correct and the other one's not. But the only way the animal has of determining which is the correct response is by whether they can feel an interoceptive drug condition. So if they can feel intoxicated, they then learn that perhaps, for example, pressing the right lever is the correct thing to do. If they don't feel intoxicated, if they received a placebo, they then say, no, I didn't get drug, and they press the left no lever, and animals can be trained to essentially detect their own intoxication as much as any human might well report, I feel drunk or whatever. They're basically, I think, learning about their how they feel under the influence of the drug and learning how to use that information to solve a behavioral problem. And so we can learn a lot about how animals perceive drug effects by this mechanism, because they're quite able to tell us whether they feel it or not, and they can, you know, or they can even distinguish between drugs and tell us, hey, this one feels like cocaine, that one feels like heroin, or whatever question we want to pose to them.
And what organisms have you mainly used?
Rats and monkeys. More lately, mice a little bit because of the importance of the neural, of the molecular biology stuff.
At the time that I further reflection on your question about what's changed. I mean, when that work began, the idea of, you know, applying sort of what would be considered behavioral psychology principles to drug action, for example, drugs as reinforcers from the Drug Self Administration, or drugs as discriminative stimuli from the drug discrimination experiments. That whole idea that drugs would be essentially functioning like food pellets or lights and things of this had not penetrated the broader drug abuse field at all. It was just a small clique of people that were fundamentally tuned into this area or this way of describing drug actions. And indeed, you know, in the early days of the College on Problems of Drug Dependence meetings, for example, we felt that we weren't getting any attention for that work, and so we actually formed a separate society and had a meeting the day before the CPDD meeting so we could be sure to be heard at least among ourselves. And so in those days, one had this strong feeling like you were inventing a kind of a whole new way of thinking about drug abuse because it was really a whole new language. That language and those concepts have so infiltrated the field now that no one would ever imagine them as having at one time not been applied. So, I mean, now that fundamental learning conception of drug abuse has, I would say, in large measure replaced, you know, the views that were predominant in the late 60s about addictive personalities and things of that type that were used to explain the disease, you know, from a behavioral social model. So I think, you know, in a way, I guess that work proved to be right in some sense, or at least certainly proved to be helpful in describing the disorders and coming up with experimental approaches to studying it.
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in conceptual change, language change. Mm-hmm. How would you, well, let's talk about those prevailing ideas in the field. Certainly the people at Lexington had an interest in physiological dependence,
yep.
Et cetera.
Right.
How would you describe their, whatever the prevailing model was, the prevailing set of explanations, et cetera, mm-hmm. At Lexington, at the other sort of major centers, at Michigan, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what, if you mm-hmm. map out the field, mm-hmm. could you, mm-hmm. in terms of prevailing ideas, how would you do it?
Well, I certainly agree with you about Lexington and the fact that they had, because they were so much of an opiate abuse, you know, residential prison facility, they defined addiction very substantially in pharmacologic terms, and you would barely hear any kind of psychiatric terminology used at all by the people I think of as the leaders there, you know, William R. Martin and Harris Isbell and these folks, although many of them, I believe, were psychiatrists, some of them were, and some were pharmacologists, but it was a very pharmacologic orientation and very oriented towards the phenomenon of physical dependence, which they really, you know, learned a lot about it there. That was somewhat of a unique feature of the fact that they were basically mainly dealing with heroin addicts. And so, of course, that is a very prominent feature as they began to get people there that had, you know, stimulant abuse disorders and others, that they sort of changed appropriate too and became more interested in some of the psychological effects, and of course the Addiction Research Center inventory, which came from there, was an attempt to in a way describe or understand the differences among drugs. And so that was certainly a model that I think was important, and really that, I guess I'm not really, I was really young at those days. I mean, I was just really at that time, you know, 20. So I really couldn't easily say that I had a vision at that point as to who was doing what. But certainly Michigan, you know, had a lot of was the powerhouse of pharmacology. Maurice Sievers, again, a very physical dependence oriented group. You know, that was the early days of the College Improv of Drug Dependence, too. The non-addicting analgesic, you know, goal is it with which I think I realized fairly early that it just didn't seem like it to me that that was going to solve any kind of drug abuse problem. It was certainly a valid goal, but it didn't really seem to me that it was going to solve a drug abuse problem. It was, you know, it was. There were other. If they found a non-addicting analgesic, that wouldn't mean that heroin wouldn't be available.
Indeed.
And so, it just wasn't obvious to me why that was essentially a solution to the problem. It was important science for sure. You know, the other models that were around then, of course, there was a sort of this addictive personality idea, or the sort of a kind of a more psychiatric model where people were basically this was a symptom of some sort of a disorder and.
An underlying disorder.
Yeah, underlying disorder. And that didn't turn out to be wrong at all in any sense, because the comorbidity is a key feature of the substance abuse as we know it now. But I really couldn't pin down who I had exactly or where I think that comes from, who the most, you know, because it wasn't something I cared much about and didn't really read. I didn't.
But you had a feeling that it was a predominant view.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, surely there was always, you always get those sort of questions about, you know, well, you know, well, if, what you know, what were their, what was their early life experience? Or there things that kind of reflected a more analytic viewpoint? Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there was this strong sort of deviance model, I suppose, that you know, came from more of the sociologists and criminologists and people of that type who really didn't use the language at all of disease, you know, languages or anything related to. A behavioral disorder, disorders at all. This was a sort of an antisocial activity that, and I was, you know, well aware of that model, of course, because that was what was seemed to dominate the you know, the drug prevention programs and the things that we would see on television brochures. I remember getting piles of old, you know, of drug prevention booklets put out by the government with. Mm-hmm. Amazingly lurid pictures, you know, and I remember one called Hooked, and it was just, you know, incredibly sensationalistic and seemed fairly off the mark from terms of what I knew. But in any case, that's about as good as I can do with that. I think, you know, as time came along and I became more involved, now I could probably tell a little bit more about which centers emerged, but at the time it was really... I'd say that pharmacologic model was certainly the one I was most connected to, because it was represented in CBDD so strongly. It was in the pharmacology textbooks. It was sort of the Bibles that I had read for that.
Yes. Okay, let's go back to how do you say the name of Isgdar, or how do you?
Yeah. Well, it was the International Study Group Investigating Drugs as Reinforcers.
But surely you had a.
Iskadar.
Okay.
which is just the first letters of those words I said, you know, and I don't have any idea where that crazy name came from. It's a pretty bizarre one, although I, in fact, didn't describe the group. Well, I was around, you know, in the beginnings of that. I was not a mover shaker with that, because there were a lot more senior people to me that were, you know.
And who were they?
Well, let's see. I guess probably I would imagine Joe Brady was probably really a very important guy. There would be certainly better historical sources than me. I remember that it kind of must have come about in the very early 70s, and I think I remember an organizational meeting at Ann Arbor, but I could be wrong about when the first one was. I think I might actually have a complete set of newsletters, which would be an interesting historical source.
Indeed.
I don't think too many people have that. And,
yeah.
It's equally interesting for people interested in this history to have a full set of the College on Problems of Drug Dependence proceedings. That's also, unfortunately, a very rare commodity. I know that my boss, Lou Harris, my ex-boss, but I'll never stop calling him my boss, has, I think, a complete set. And I also know that it's deteriorating pretty seriously, just the physical condition of the pages.
It's such a problem in this field, the assumption that it's outmoded.
Yeah.
It's really important to house this stuff.
Yeah, I know, and it would be worth developing some sort of a way of saying, anyway, the Iskandar Med, I mean, my first important involvement in that, I would say probably actually maybe one of the most important things I did in my career was as I mentioned, the people doing these sort of laboratory animal model work sort of felt a little bit like second-class citizens, mm-hmm. and we had to sort of prove our stuff. Now, I think in retrospect, that was we were actually getting recognized pretty fine, and things were probably better. But it was a little bit more fun to be, I suppose, thought to be an outsider, coming in. And we, anyway, to make a long story short, there became a need to validate the models. We felt we need to prove them, and so one of the ways that the self-administration model had been proven over the years, I suppose, validated, is to show that animals like to take the same drugs that people like to take. And so at that time, people were just, it was, very exciting because, you just pulled drugs off the shelf and asked monkeys if they would self-administer them or not. And so people were just, running through their shells, finding out but a lot of that stuff wasn't necessarily well organized. People were just testing things. I know Bob Harris the guy that was my advisor and the laboratory director had very low interest in publication, and we must have collected, easily 5 or 10 times more data than we ever published it, because he didn't have a keen interest in that. I certainly didn't carry that beyond that point, because I once learned that that wasn't a good plan. But anyway, there were a lot of things that were unpublished at those days, people just testing. And so Iskandar, one of its first sort of, I guess, official activities was to try to collect from all the member investigators a list of all these drugs they had tested, and try to assemble essentially a long list, and take that list then and see whether or not these are mostly abused drugs or whatever. So Chris Johansson, who was a person more in my generation, I would say, we were young people, obviously, we were tasked with creating data sheets and for collecting this information from investigators around the world. And so obviously a thrill for me to be able to call these Joe Brady or whatever and ask them for data is a pretty big kick. So I collected, Chris and I collected all those data, and we published a paper in the 1978, I believe it was, in the Bulletin on Narcotics, which is still really actually fairly widely cited, because it was at that time a list of all the drugs that monkeys would take. And it was a pretty impressive list. They did take drugs that people like. So anyway, that was an activity, because it helped and essentially create a validity for that particular model. So it was a necessary activity, but it was I think certainly fun to do it as a younger investigator to be given this responsibility.
Yeah. I was going to ask you what you consider your most important conceptual contributions, and we'll start with that one. What else?
Well, I certainly, I mean, I guess because we didn't read, someone just earlier in this meeting made a comment about one of the mentors who kept walking in the lab and say that some people read the literature and other people make it. That was characterized my advisor to a T. He really never read anything, and he just had ideas. He was a very creative man, but he was not he was not a very serious scholar, in fact, not a very serious person at all. And so we did a lot of research that we just sort of came up with. And in fact, we published, I think, really one of the very first true drug discrimination papers in 1968. And literally, Bob and I we just sit around the lab and talk about that first paper was a bit interesting because...
Bob.
Bob Harris. Robert T. Harris, Bob Harris, and the 1968 paper in Psychonomic Science, a journal not widely known. It's like a 2-page paper, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's not quite my first paper, because I think I had some distant authorship on some chemistry thing or something, but it was near my first paper, and it's what I did my dissertation on. But in any case, the idea behind it was that you know, we psychologists were kind of fairly cocky and figured we could make a drug do anything we want, you know, by arranging the behavioral circumstances. We could make a stimulant a depressant. We can, if you want a blue light, we'll, you know, we'll just do whatever. So we, our deal was that, well, look, if we want to make amphetamine into a depressant, all we need to do is have the animal associate it with responding slow. What we did is we trained animals that when they received placebo, they had to respond fast. And they would get reinforced under a fixed ratio schedule, which rewards fast responding. Then we said, well, if they want to, you know, if we gave them amphetamine on days we gave them amphetamine, the only way they'd get reinforced with food was by responding slow. So we used something which is called a differential reinforcement of low rate schedule, which rewards slow responding. And so pretty soon the animals learned that when they felt amphetamine, they should slow down, and when they felt placebo, they should speed up. And so we could, you know, any time we wanted, we could make an animal go fast or go slow. And the kick there was that we turned, you know, amphetamine from a stimulant into a depressant, if you think about it in a kind of a loose terms. And that was, so I think that idea that you essentially can, by a certain amount of training, and of course, drug abusers, you know, gain a lot of experience under the influence of drugs and learn a lot about drugs in the course of the development of the disorder. So I think, you know, having contributed to that conceptualization that, you know, drug effects are quite malleable in the broad sense of the word, that they just don't do the same thing to everybody. A lot of it depends on the circumstances under which they're used and this sort of thing, that we really could begin to explain individual differences. And so I think that was a fairly important one. I mean, there are many other people than I that, you know, contributed importantly to that, but I think it's important. And we began to develop that drug discrimination model and sort of, you know, develop variations on it that became widely used. But
how far would you push that malleability? There are some people in my field who would say, oh, yes, well, drugs are what we would call socially constructed.
Right.
In other words, their effects derive
from the context
from
in which
the
they're taken.
Context.
And yeah,
yes.
Sure, right. Yeah.
So how far would you?
Well, that's correct. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would go probably as far as you would, if not further, I suppose. I mean, they are, I mean, of course, they have sort of inherent properties that, you know, make them more or less likely to serve different functions or produce different effects. So, I mean, it isn't as likely that amphetamine is going to slow you down, mm-hmm. you know, but it is certainly, you know, very easily imagine that it can under certain circumstances. So I think there's no limit to the contextual control. I think you can take a drug with essentially no pharmacological characteristics that would be, you know, indicative of abuse. But, you know, if someone told you it was great and you were having a wonderful time and it was part of some kind of a scene, I'm sure you could turn it into a drug of abuse. You know, and of course there are maybe examples of that. There was that whole banana skin smoking thing that went on when I remember, where people somehow word got out, and then there was the aspirin and coke one where people thought, oh, you get high on aspirin and coke, and as far as I know, neither of those are true. It certainly didn't stop, you know, millions of people from doing it, and I'm pretty sure that was entirely context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. So any other conceptual contributions that you want to add to that list?
Well, so, you know, I don't know. I haven't actually been thought that way before exactly about it. But so, of course, over the years, I've had a very strong involvement in the issue of abuse potential assessment. This is sort of, again, using animal models, and now even more recently kind of a broader data set to think about that. And so just the whole conceptualization of how you go about it. I've served kind of like on a lot of the, you know, relevant committees over the years that sort of have been involved in that mm-hmm. arena of applying science to this business of drug scheduling. I was, you know, on the FDA Drug Abuse Advisory Committee and chaired it for a while. I've been on, you know, WH.
Was it active?
Yeah, that's when it was active. A very effective and active committee in those days, absolutely. And very, I think, really a extremely good source of valuable information to the FDA, mm-hmm. and
fellow named Ed Tokas was the head guy for the drug section there, and you know, really knew a lot about the field. And at any rate, that I was on the WHO advisory panel, wrote you know a number of reviews or documents related to WH, you know, to the issues related to the WHO. Some of these were, you know, really basically done just as WHO sort of internal documents, but had really basically was quite involved in that. So I think just the whole idea that you know, science is important in this regulatory field. I'm probably not the most important person, but I think I've been doing a lot in that area for a long time, and kind of got politically connected to that, and that carried over to an area that I think most people don't associate necessarily with me. But I did do a lot of work in the area, and this is an area called behavioral toxicology, where we began to be concerned that regulation of environmental chemicals were being done without a scientific database. We knew that so many of the environmental contaminants that are actually a public health problem are damaging the nervous system. But in actual fact, you know, the way things are, there's essentially no fundamental safety net there that prevents companies from putting those things out. It became obvious as I got to doing work, I got a grant to work in that area and then began collecting data on what was called behavioral toxicology, and worked with different people. Probably the most important would be Ron Wood, on working hard actually to lobby and fuss with the government as they develop, for example, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which was the regulatory vehicle that ultimately led to an improvement in the safety evaluation of environmental contaminants. And I was pretty active during those days in a sort of, I would say, advocacy, but also data gathering. Was involved with that, the Behavioral Toxicology Society, and doing things. So it was the same idea in a sense that we wanted, policy or regulatory policy that grounded in science is really better than any of the alternatives I'm aware of. So I felt that view strongly, and I've continued to push it.
Yes, that's wonderful. Takes care of a whole bunch of questions I had at the end. Given that you've worked at these various levels of government, for want of a better word,
advocacy or something.
Where did you see yourself being most effective?
That's sort of the trouble, in a way, with government work, if you will, or advocacy. It's very hard to know when you're effective. I mean, you don't very often, see exactly that something you did exactly was the thing that caused that. You know, so you do kind of. It's a very thankless work. I really admire people who spend their careers doing mainly that, because you could go for a whole career and not be really sure that you changed anything, because it's just such a kind of a big and complicated mess. I just became more interested in politics, and so I just a variety of things led to that. I suppose it was certainly involvement with these regulatory activities, and being on the committees, and of course being the chair kind of threw me into a more of a, I guess, a politically sensitive role. I mean, for example, I was the chair of the committee when Nicorette gum came through, and it was a huge issue because it was really the case that Nicorette gum met the criteria of the Controlled Substances Act for a controlled substance. It was, in fact, a medication designed to treat an addiction, and it was the drug itself. So I mean, of course, none of us wanted Nicorette gum to be controlled under the Controlled Substances Act. But if we were to actually apply the language of the act, it's very obvious that it met the criteria. Now the FDA wanted to just run that right on through and just, no one's going to control Nicorette. And I said, well, we better have a hearing on that, because, if by saying that we're not going to look at this, you're going to essentially say that nicotine's not an addicting, doesn't meet the CSA requirements, and that's telling the world something that's incorrect. So we pushed that, and they did have a hearing on Nicorette gum when it became clear that, yes, nicotine did have fit the criteria of addicting substance, but it simply wasn't practical to turn the gum into a controlled substance. and actually, you know, for a lot of reasons. But I mean, it was the case that you couldn't, at least one of the relatively early times that the federal government, in a sense, you know, passed off on the idea that yes, nicotine is an addictive substance. I mean, the Surgeon General had been saying it, but this was now the FDA,
yes.
And so anyway, that kind of thing. So that kind of got me in the middle of it. Then I got involved with the college on problems of drug dependence, and just sort of found myself on public policy committees. I'm not quite sure why, but then began to assume a major role. So then for many years, I was the public policy officer for this College on Problems of Drug Dependence, and essentially managed their Washington advocacy group that handled their, you know, their advocacy matters with Congress, regulatory matters, and I worked pretty hard, you know, with them on that. Got involved in, you know, a lot of things, both in terms of just the standard NIH budgetary matters,
right,
but a lot of more kind of detailed things related to specific. I remember working hard on the Pharmacotherapy Act, you know, that came out of Biden's shop and things like that. So these are, I put, you know, a lot of hours into all those things. Now, whether they had any influence on how things came out, I don't know. I guess we'll take a historian to figure it out. Because I don't know. But I certainly met with a lot of people and did, you know, I think it's helpful in those situations to have sort of a white coat scientist, mm-hmm. you know, to go there and do the talking. I mean, it is the case that we're not, you know, necessarily know all the players and all the political angles, but I think, you know, honestly, trotting out a scientist. So I did a fair bit of testimony and ended up doing that then with, got on the American Psychological Association Board of Scientific Affairs, which is a fairly high level advisory body within American Psychological Association, and that has a lot of policy implications. I mean, I was the chair of that on literally I got the chair on exactly the time when I'm going to have trouble remembering the name of it, but it was the book that essentially was about racial differences in intelligence and
the bell curve.
Bell curve, exactly. Thank you. And so, you know, that was that APA, you know, that was a incredibly politically charged issue on which science, you know, has something to say. And American Psychological Association felt, you know, that they should say something because it's sort of, you know, so they did, but they said the wrong things. And so it was a mess because they angered lots of people. They angered just about everybody because they didn't really. So that was I would say that was a trial by fire, just getting involved in that and trying to work out a more reasoned way for the APA to respond to these kind of things. So I don't know. I've spent a lot of time on those over many years, I can describe all these times. I mean, I don't know what makes a difference or not, but it's, I think it's important for people to do that. So I kind of continue to be a little bit involved in advocacy related stuff, and mm-hmm. I was toying for a while with I interviewed with General McCaffrey for the job that replaced Herb Cleaver as the mm-hmm. demand reduction guy, and you know, I got a little interested in that. You know, I sort of had a certain grudging admiration for General McCaffrey and his sort of can-do attitude, and I actually had, to be honest, actually thought that their national drug control strategy was actually not so bad. You know, I mean, it just didn't seem to be reflected in what they were actually doing. But mm-hmm. anyway, I almost took that job. I was got pretty close, and I'm probably really glad I didn't. But it would have been definitely a trial by fire at a higher level of, you know, policy involvement. But anyway, that's a smattering of these things. There's many
yes.
more, but.
Yeah. How let's go back to the Controlled Substances Act. Wouldn't any pharmacotherapy face that problem, essentially?
You mean pharmacotherapy for addiction or just any kind of psychiatric med?
For addiction.
Yeah, probably, but some would be a no-brainer. I mean, like naltrexone is a narcotic antagonist.
Sure.
No one in their wildest dreams would think that it could be abused. So it wouldn't. It faces the opposite problem. It faces the difficulty of convincing the FDA that it can work, which again is another problem. There's a lot of difficulties in defining outcomes in drug abuse treatment, and that has plagued us because we sort of have, I think, you know, too high of a demand for what an effective treatment is. I mean, actually, Tom McClellan probably, you know, describes this the best of anybody right now. But I mean, he points out, you know, if I have high blood pressure and I go see my doc and they give me a beta blocker, my blood pressure goes down. They say I've been treated, and then if they take the blood pressure, the beta blocker away, my blood pressure goes up, and they say it goes to show you that it worked. And in fact, for most chronic diseases, that's exactly what happens. You go on a medication, fix the condition, and then when you take the medication away, the condition reappears. It actually very powerful demonstration that the treatment worked. Mm-hmm. Drug abuse is that isn't it's the opposite in a way. You give the treatment, you take it away, and if people come back to go back to using drugs, they say it didn't work. Sort of an odd conceptualization of the problem, and you know that of course gets into you know what would the FDA want in terms of evidence of efficacy, and I think. You know, Tom has been arguing that, you know, really, if you want to know whether the medication works, test the people while they're on medication. Mm-hmm. Seems almost too logical to be, but it isn't by any means. Most people wouldn't agree with that. You say we put people on methadone, and you know, if they relapse when they get off methadone, then everybody says methadone failed, and even though they may have well been on it for 5 years and doing fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Do you think, back to the Controlled Substances Act, thinking about how effective abuse liability testing has become, do you think we're doing the best we can at this point? I mean, are we good at predicting? Have we been good at predicting abuse liability?
I think pretty good. Yes. I would say there's not been a whole lot of really serious misses, you know, in the sense of where we absolutely missed, you know, a serious drug abuse problem that was, you know, and that the drug was approved and that it turned out to be, you know, a terrible drug abuse problem. I suppose maybe we've even potentially over-regulated a few things just because, you know, and I'll call that kind of comes down to politics in a sense of how conservative do various versions of the FDA want to be and things along that line. But I think in a fundamental sense, the ability to predict and monitor abuse liability is a pretty, when you consider how complex the phenomena of abuse is, you know, with all of its many manifestations and the context sensitivity we were talking about earlier, and everything, the fact that we can do it as well as we can, you know, it'd be one thing if you're just going to predict whether or not a drug lowers blood pressure, that's a pretty easy, you know, thing to measure. But drug abuse, you know, so I think we do pretty good. And it's a very important issue that I think people tend to underestimate. They just don't understand where all the implications of that comes. I mean, just for example, among it, it has to do with the perception of the process of drug regulation, and especially when it comes to new medications. I mean, companies are very, you know, they do cost-benefit analyses and risk analyses, and they might have to have some certainty that they can kind of predict what's going to happen, because the regulatory decisions about their medications have a huge impact on whether they're going to be successful from a financial point of view, and the companies don't really like to be unpredictable. And so they kind of really, I think in some ways, are the biggest supporters we have for science. You know, as the main, because science, you can at least, you know, do it and then measure it and make a prediction, and at least you have an agreed upon way to do it. If it begins to be too arbitrary, and you know, we've had situations where Congress has, you know, scheduled drugs, and this, you know, regardless of what you think of the final result of that, the important point is having Congress do it is not really the way you would ideally design a system. I can't imagine an FDA drug company would be particularly keen on, you know, having a major aspect of the approval of their drug become a matter of congressional action. So, you know, all that does to them, and when they see, you know, a certain amount of unpredictability and or perhaps, you know, loosening of the role of science in these decision-making problems, all that does is have to make the companies and have them march in the other direction. They got better things to do with their time and money. And of course, addiction treatment products are the ones where this is, you were mentioning earlier, a lot of them are going to have this problem. So seems, you know, logical to me that they're going to look at the situation. If they get a sense that there's a certain amount of chaos, then they're going to just say, hey, you know, we're not going to jump into this. So, you know, nobody would really know that. How would you measure that impact? By non-starts.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. All right. Okay, so as we wind up here, there may be some things that I think we were talking earlier about models and prevailing ideas, and you said something to the effect, we talked about the models that were prevalent in the field the time that you entered it,
right.
And how would you now describe that or map that out today?
Yeah, I do kind of think that in a very broad sense, a learning theory model has really become sort of the standard language in the drug abuse field, certainly in a setting like this of the College on Problems of Drug Dependence. I mean, there's just nobody that would, you know, even flinch at calling, you know, when you talk about a drugs a reinforcer, and people have very much, I think, come to understand a learning theory view, and I think it has, you know, really become, in a sense, the standard model. Now, there are people say that it doesn't, you know, explain enough, and that's all fine and good. I think it probably doesn't in some sort of fundamental sense.
And who says that? Which kind
of people? Well, I mean, of course, there's the whole brain changes thing. So, I mean, there are, you know, people who feel like, you know, that, yeah, sure, drug, you know, people learn to take drugs the way they learn to do other bad habits, and everything is fine and good. But at some point, you know, the drug changes their brain in a way that this, now that whole process has been undermined, and now we have a new process that's driven by some biological imperative of a changed brain. And, you know, I don't know what people think exactly. I mean, learning, what is learning? I mean, the brain changes, you know, for learning. I mean, it doesn't happen in the toe, you know. So it is a biological, I mean, the substrate of learning is the brain. There's no question about it. And obviously, different parts of the brain are involved in learning different things. So all that part is true. I don't see where that seems to me just stating the obvious. The issue that, you know, somehow there becomes some sort of, you know, a change in the biological imperative, I think that just becomes more of a definitional issue. I mean, the data seem to me to suggest that no matter what, you can take extremely afflicted, you know, drug abusing patients and bring them into a laboratory, and they'll exhibit very orderly behavior in choosing drugs or choosing money or doing this. Their behavior is not out of control. It's mm-hmm. under very good control. It's under control of drugs. So, I mean, I don't know that it's been all that helpful to suggest that there's some sort of a, I don't know, when I say the word switch, people are going to say, oh, that Alan Leshner, because that was sort of where that came from. But I think, you know, it's the switch metaphor is not really a particularly good one, I don't think, for what's going on. It's very much more of a rheostat of anything. And, you know, it. So I think that's been the biggest benefit by far of the sort of the switch ideas, or the idea that there's some kind of a real, like a almost a real reversible brain change, is that it has been a vehicle for drawing in a lot of incredibly great neuroscience. Mm-hmm. I mean, that provides a rationale and a significance of section for a grant, and it provides everything that, you know, top flight neuroscientists and molecular biologists need to write their grants. And so we're learning amazing things about these brain changes, and I think this is all for the good.
Right.
But
so in other words, I also do you include the chronic relapsing brain disorder definition?
Yeah.
That redefinition is part of this.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that. I think that in a way that language, at least I associate that with sort of the medical model, the disease model, mm-hmm. which is sort of a variant, another kind of a different model to some extent. But I mean, it's not incompatible with any of these other ones. It is a chronic relapsing brain disorder.
So that switch metaphor, the redefinition, these had the effect of, in essence, raising the status of the field or bringing it more to the attention of neuroscience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think exactly. That's exactly what, that's, you know, I mean, that's been a fairly stated goal. People recognize that certain decision makers and people are very impressed with these, you know, biological things. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I think it's fine, but I mean, and it's been great because it has been a necessary thing in order to sort of remain current. I guess I'm sounding like, you know, these things were not needed to be done. I think they were needed to be done, but I mean, certainly a benefit of going that direction has been that it has, in fact, in a way, legitimatized drug abuse research within the broader neuroscience community, and that's really all for the good. Mm-hmm.
And yet there's something, having been a long time inhabitant of this field, there's something about it that's not fully consonant with your ways of thinking.
Yeah, I think so. It's just a sort of idea that that the brain's in charge, kind of, I think. I guess really, I think the brain obviously is involved in all behavior, but I don't know. I just don't really think you're not going to really honestly find the broadest possible definition for individual differences in vulnerability to addiction in brain parts. I think it's going to be much more caught up in the much broader contextual situation in which people. I mean, is the brain, you know, of a observant Muslim who never drinks or touches any kind of a drug at all, you know, really different from, you know, that's not where the difference for that huge difference comes.
Yes.
We have huge, you know, trends over years and decades in drug use in the United States, up and down, you know, following various. Do we think that the brains of the species have been undergoing some sort of evolutionary process that flows with those ebbs and flows? I don't believe that, you know, that those levels of analysis have a prayer of explaining the phenomena that are occurring at the macro level, like the you know, changes in population dynamics of drug use and stuff. Those come about through much broader things. So, yeah, you need to know really how the drug works in the brain and what it's doing, and that's all kind of important, very important for medication development, because you want to sort of change the situation around. But I don't believe it really offers a very satisfactory explanatory basis on which you could really mount an overriding theory or concept of the phenomenon.
Yes. Wonderful. Is there anything I didn't ask that I should have, or anything else that you want to say? When you get this, you may find, especially with our last conversation, where you were sort of exploring things, you may find that you have more to say.
Mm-hmm.
Feel free to either say it or write it.
Yeah, okay. I don't really know. I mean, obviously, I can always talk about more stuff, but I think that says important stuff. I mean, what's become interesting to me, and what there's been two sort of recent events in my own career that's really had somewhat of a transforming experience that I recommend to people, maybe not until they get a little later on. But one of these is becoming a journal editor, and I'm an editor, the editor in chief of Drug and Alcohol Dependence. This is a multidisciplinary journal that's got everything in there from, you know, biochemistry to economics and history, and it's forced me to really develop a much broader appreciation for all of those fields of inquiry and just learn more about their methods and operations. And I mean, at this point in my life, I know more about, you know, less in a sense. I mean, I know less about more, I guess.
Yes.
I have a very broad understanding of a whole lot of these disciplines, but it's been pretty transforming because I do believe I've been, my brain's been changed to to now see this as a much more complicated and much more multidisciplinary phenomenon. And then I got, I guess maybe because of my willingness to say that, I guess I got assigned or chosen to be on one of the Robert Wood Johnson Tobacco Etiology Research Network, which is a really amazing phenomenon. It's about a dozen, you know, senior scientists from a, you know, broad range of areas, from neurobiology to economics and psychology and pediatrics and whatever. And we're supposed to try to figure, we got 10, you know, we were given 10 years to figure out why kids smoke. And sadly, we're getting towards the end of that, and we haven't figured it out yet, but we really, you know, have thought about the problem way differently, because you can't help but do that when you're faced with having to explain yourself in that kind of an environment. And so the term that's now being applied to that is transdisciplinary. It's kind of like everybody's trying to, you know, I guess you're just trying to out-multiple, you know. So, I mean, there's people, of course, have written a lot about that word and how that's different than multidisciplinary. And my guess is that won't be long and we'll see omnidisciplinary or something. I don't know. But it is a different experience. And I think, you know, I think there is that's the hardest thing I think the sciences have to do. Is to really integrate these areas across their broad domains and really make sense of what's coming about. And I think we've got some things going with that network that, they're just really, they're in their real infancy. We just kind of got started with them, but they're really unusual ways of going about collecting data and thinking about the problem that I really hope, you know, makes a difference in the way people think about it. And it certainly does have the advantages of, you know, putting, you know, brain biology in there along with contexts and, you know, anthropologists and sociologists and all that sort of thing. And everybody's right. The more you listen to them, the more you realize that there's not a single wrong person on that group. And so the question is, what are they right about? And how do you connect those pieces? It's not easy to connect a brain cell with a social context, but anyway, I think that I kind of hope to continue to do that sort of stuff for a while. It seems pretty interesting from a scholarly point of view. I kind of, you know, I got tenure and I'm a professor, right. And I don't really need to. So I can kind of play. I'm not sure I'd recommend this of a, you know, assistant professor because they better do their stuff and, you know, make sure they know, get to be a good scientist, but I think it's an important thing, and it's not easy to figure out who's going to pay for that kind of work to be done. It's such a kind of, I would say, high risk to that. You know, you can put 10 people in a room for 10 years, and you could get a bunch of nothing, and maybe history will show this to be a bunch of nothing, too, but we'll see.
Hopefully not. Yeah. Do you know